Do you want to connect with clinicians, partners, investors, and experts who can speed up your scale-up in health tech? Our hands-on mentorship, guidance, and the program's suite of benefits can help you navigate the path to commercialization like the insider you'll soon be. To apply to be a Rosenman Innovator, go to rosenmaninstitute.org. Applications are open through April 12th. And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Connor Landgraf, the co-founder and CEO of Echo. Echo provides improved cardiac and pulmonary screening by combining their digital stethoscope and ECG devices with patient and provider software and AI-powered analysis. Their goal is to give physicians the ability to listen to heart and lung sounds with greater confidence. Connor founded Echo while studying bioengineering at UC Berkeley. Their technology is now used in more than 4,000 hospitals, health systems, and practices across the US and Europe. We discussed the topic of recognizing an opportunity for growth in an industry, persevering through the challenges of finding early investors, and holding onto the core of the company's mission. And so here's our conversation. Well, welcome, Connor. Thanks for joining me today. It's sunny out here in San Francisco, and I heard you said it's sunny out in Albany, too. So Albany, California, not Albany, New York. Yeah. I thought it would be really interesting for our listener to hear a bit about your background. I mean, you started Echo right out of school when you're at Berkeley, out of a project, and how, you know, maybe you can share with us how you come about with the ideas and then the decision to move forward with the idea to create a company.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on today, Christine. Excited to chat about the story of Echo and how we got going. And I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. But to share a little bit more about the founding of Echo. So rewinding the clock back a few years, I was in grad school doing my master's at Berkeley in bioengineering in the MEng program there. And there's some deep ties between that program and UCSF. So it's great to have good faculty connections between the med school and the engineering department. As part of that school curriculum, got the chance to take a class devoted to med device development. And this is a class with Amy Herr. She's a bioengineering professor at Cal. And the class is devoted to like zero to one, soup to nuts. You know, how do you build a med device in a hypothetical scenario? And so you tackle things like needs finding exercises, looking at clinical challenges, clinical workflow issues, identifying the engineering challenges you need to address, the regulatory challenges, the product challenges, the go-to-market challenges, doing this in a fictional capacity for a medical device. And it's a really instructive class. But that year we got the chance to do an exercise devoted to common medical technology. And we got to talk to some primary care physicians about how they use clinical tools in their practice. And, of course, every clinician has the stethoscope around their neck because that's the icon of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we were talking to them about how they use that in their practice. And these doctors said some pretty stunning things. They said, really, the stethoscope wasn't that useful for them clinically. They didn't feel confident using it as a diagnostic tool. And there was even a physician who said, I just do it because my patient expects me to do it. And that was like mind blowing to me. I'm not a physician, but my intuition was that stethoscope is a pretty important tool. But it was so fascinating to hear that that really wasn't necessarily the case. And it kind of started, it was the first moment that started me on this journey to understand what is in heart sounds and lung sounds that we're listening to with the stethoscope, and how can physicians use that better to make clinical decisions. And, discovered that sound is a really, really rich source of information. We're encoding information about blood flow, about turbulent flow through the heart valves, about the movement of breath through the, you know, the airways of the lungs. All of that is encoded in sound, mm-hmm. but you have to use your ears to do that pattern matching process. And we're very imprecise with that. And in the same way that so few people have a musical ear, so few people have the training necessary to really use the stethoscope accurately.
And how does the physician got trained? Because you hear, they must, you know, and then they have to somehow train the medical students. This is what you need to hear and look out for.
Yeah. Training on auscultation, training on heart sounds and lung sounds is incredibly hard. You do rounding, you try to hear interesting murmurs in your patients, you try to bring your med students together to listen to it. For many people, they just use CDs or, you know, sound recordings to play it back over and over again so that they can practice it and hear those differences. So it's just repetition. That's kind of the only way that you can learn any sort of a sound or music. And that's, you know, very, very cumbersome and time consuming for most clinicians.
So walk us back a little bit, because you mentioned about, you know, when you are assigned to a primary care physicians for your project, yep. and it was just totally random. You saw this stethoscope. It's like, hey, what do you guys use that for? Mm-hmm. It was just that one simple question. Is that it or?
Yeah, no, I mean, that was it. It was, you know, how does this tool get used in your clinical practice and what are the ways that we can improve it? And, you know, kind of started to understand that really it wasn't used that meaningfully in a clinical setting. And, you know, our thought, my thought approaching it from a computer science background was there are incredible tools that can do audio pattern recognition that can identify sounds. Shazam, Siri, Alexa, Theory, all of these vocal assistant tools we have, they're very good. And there's been so much investment in speech and voice recognition technologies. Why can't we approach that same problem for healthcare sounds and apply that to heart sounds, lung sounds, and make this make physicians more confident in their diagnostic processes, mm-hmm. And then give that ability for patients outside the clinic too, so we can understand dynamic changes in heart or lung function.
So from that project, you come up with the idea of the echo. And so that's more on trying to understand the clinical needs. And then during that process, what are the input that you get from the physician, because they're not the easiest person to convince to change and pick up a new toy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did spend a lot of time trying to build different versions of the product to fit with physicians' expectations of what a stethoscope looked like, fit their workflow. We recognized early on that physicians are incredibly busy, and any tool that changes that workflow adds more time to their incredibly packed schedule as it is. It's just a non-starter. So I'd say, you know, we went through a lot of evolutions, and we're still going through evolutions to ensure that the product is as smooth as possible, that it, you know, fits into the patient's workflow as much as possible. But that's a never-ending optimization problem. And so I think every day the product team wakes up and tries to focus on how do we make this more simple and more straightforward for physicians to use.
At what moment that you realize that, oh, this could be more than just a capstone project? Or, you know, I'm a big fan of Amy Herr. She's one of our advisors. And actually, I work with her on some of this project. And I did not happen to work on your project because we matched the different students with different UCSF faculty. So, but anyway, so at what moment is that, okay, I'm going to do it?
Yeah, yeah.
Forget about looking for a job.
Yeah, we're heading towards graduation, and there was this gnawing question of like, all right, should I go pursue a consulting role? Should I go pursue software at a tech company? You know, where am I headed to next? And we did get to leverage some great resources on campus, some grant programs and some university accelerators to help us make that transition more easily from classroom to company. And so I think basically for the first year or so, we kind of scrounged up space, scrounged up a few dollars in grant funding to keep working on the project. And then towards the end of that first year, really realized, okay, this is something we can really start to take this and build a company out of it. And so went out to raise a true kind of seed round of capital. Obviously, you know, really early on. And so the most, we were selling a vision. There wasn't really any proof to it. We knew that there was a long, you know, regulatory roadmap ahead of us. It was going to take us a while to get through the FDA. But thankfully we had some great early investors who believed in the idea and gave us some funding to make it a reality.
So walk us, if we can go back to memory lane. I mean, you just get out from school. This is probably your first startup that you lead or you led. And, you know, finding the first investor is always hard. I always say that every investor is always hard, but, you know, the first one always gives you that little boost. But for that, what process, like how many doors do you knock before you get there? Don't tell me your first door.
No, it was not. It took a lot of knocking to get that first seed capital. I think we probably met with 50 or 70 investors early on. And I think what we really started to realize that fundraising is a long game. It's never going to be easy. You're never going to have someone immediately say yes, regardless of how well you're doing. And so you just have to keep knocking on doors. And eventually you'll start to understand how to change your pitch. You'll understand what is important to investors and how you need to change, your approach to the business. And so it's a very iterative process. I mean, it's pitch, learn, test, iterate, and then do that again. And so the more you can do that, the more and more you're likely going to be able to find the things that resonate with those investors, and more likely you'll be able to secure funding. But, you know, I think the rule of thumb that every entrepreneur should expect is fundraising takes someone's full-time job 6 months, always, and maybe longer, but at minimum 6 months of full-time work for one employee in the company to raise a round of capital. And I think when you come in with that expectation, then you know that you're going to get a lot of no's, and you can avoid the, you know, psychological challenges that every entrepreneur feels and the rejection that they feel over and over again when they get told no, because that's hard to deal with when you get told no so many times.
Somebody was telling me your goal every day when you do a fundraising is like, my goal today is to get rejected 10 times rather than the goal is to get one funding, because I think that would help you keep on going. I don't know whether that is true, but I thought that's a good advice.
If you can get 10 no's in a day, I'd say that's you have a packed schedule. but I definitely agree. I mean, and every no, the critical thing is learn from the feedback. Your goal is to have a really wide net in the beginning and then learn what resonates with investors, what part of your story they're excited about, what the weaknesses are they see in the business. And then you can start to hone in and improve your pitch, improve the business roadmap, improve your go-to-market strategy, all those pieces. You're going to get narrower and narrower and narrower until you've got that perfectly honed, perfectly crafted story that best illustrates the business. And I think if you don't go through that process of refinement, you still are going to get a lot of no's, but you're not necessarily going to get closer to that yes. So refinement is really important too.
It's kind of part of the process.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So off the team from your Berkeley project, did everybody decide to join and start the company, or did some people just decided like, you know, good luck, that was fun?
No, yeah, there was some turnover. I mean, we had some folks who were, you know, part of the team as a class project, and we had to kind of figure out, all right, who wants to make the leap? And so there was definitely some turnover in the team in the early days as we figured out, you know, who was going to stick with it for the long term. And I would say, you know, probably took a lot of guts to kind of say, I want to keep working on this when we didn't have anything. Right. So there was just a handful of people who really wanted to stick it out through all of the turmoil of fundraising and being an early stage startup.
So what kept you going? What made you feel like this is the leap that I'm going to take? I might have to eat ramen for the next year or so.
I mean, you know, for any startup founder, I think timing is incredibly important. Timing in your career where you don't have risks, you don't have a mortgage, maybe you don't have a family, and you're not necessarily worried about whether you're going to have to eat ramen for a few months. So that helps a lot in being able to completely devote your energy and focus towards one particular direction. I honestly don't think that I would have been able to make that same leap if I had been in a situation where I had a family, I had a mortgage. I just don't think I would have had the guts to do that. But I was really fortunate that it was right out of college and there wasn't really any downside to me. It was kind of like, well, you know, worst case scenario, I'll move back in with my parents and reset and move forward. So I think I was really lucky to be in a position in which there was no downside scenario to a bad outcome. I think, you know, you have to have a dogged persistence and belief in the problem that you're trying to solve. And you have to like have the conviction that you're just going to beat your head against the wall over and over and over again until you find a way to break it down. And then you also have to have self-intuition and recognition of when things aren't working and you need to shift strategies. And I think you need to have like a 50-50 mixture of that. You got to have the persistence to just say, we are going to solve this problem no matter how many tries it takes. And also, we know that it's not working right now, and we know that the assumptions we have are wrong. So we have to change our approach to solving this problem. And you know, you can't have too much of one or the other. You have to have both.
And how do you keep yourself honest with that? Right, knowing, you know, I think some people surround themselves with advisors, mm-hmm. but then sometimes the advisors said to you, like, maybe it's time for you to move to a different direction, but then your stubbornness actually mm-hmm. decided not. Like, how do you balance that?
Yeah, I think it's understanding when there is a preponderance of evidence pushing you in a different direction. And so I think it's valuable to get multiple pieces of advice from different stakeholders. You know, I think in general, it's probably never a good idea to make a decision based upon a single person's advice. You really want to get a preponderance of evidence to say, okay, you know, what do they see that I don't about this problem? But I also think you have to have your load-bearing wall assumptions about the industry or problem you're trying to solve. And those are the things that like you're going to hold dear to, which is, this is the core principle of our company, which is that, you know, audio signals are important in clinical diagnoses. And that's the thing that you just have to stay focused on. And then everything else can be changeable as long as that load-bearing wall remains fixed. Like the house is still going to stand if like those pillars and support stay there. And everything else can change around it. You can tear out doors and walls and other parts of the house, but it's not going to fall because the load-bearing wall is there. So you have to identify like what those key assumptions are, and then you have to be really confident that that is the right answer. That for us, it was, yeah, sound is an important part of clinical diagnosis. And then you can change your assumptions around elsewhere. But sometimes people may disagree on those load-bearing assumptions. Like they're, you know, that's how you can look at an industry and say, there are, you know, all the entrenched players in this industry are viewing this load-bearing wall in the wrong way. They're not recognizing the opportunity. And then that can allow you to, you know, create really powerful, large businesses quickly. So, again, it's the mix of knowing what advice to take and knowing what advice to ignore, because some people just can't see the bigger picture.
Right. And I think you have to collect all that data. Then you have that database and then come up with the decision.
Yeah.
And I think I learn as you get older, people like to say you have that intuition, but actually the intuition is really because you have gathered so much data in your brain and that become an intuition when actually it's data analysis in your brain.
Yeah.
So, you know, thinking back, like when you, you know, you're an engineer, did you ever thought that one day you'll start a company or just, you know, some people know from the get-go that like, I'm going to run a company and then, you know, being in the Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. I knew I loved entrepreneurship and I knew I loved building things. And so I hoped to be able to start a company at some point.
So you knew?
I just knew I liked building things. Like that was what I was really passionate about. And I really wanted to have, at some point in my career, I really wanted to like start something from scratch. So, to some extent, I think I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's because some people do not know and some people, you know, go for it, which is great. So now, you know, it's been a few years. You started with one product, you have multiple products now. And my question is like when developing a medical device is always hard is adoption. How do you get your first adoption? Like what is the inflection point for you guys? It's like, finally, we're getting some traction. And how do you get there?
Yeah, I don't think there is any single answer. I think you build a strategy based upon, you know, multiple pieces. For us, we saw that there was a really unique opportunity to sell our products in a B2C fashion and sell them to physicians directly. And so a big part of our strategy was e-commerce, direct sales, which is not the strategy for most med device companies. And so I think the key moments for us in that process were we saw early traction that we could acquire customers for a reasonable price. And I think that's the very first step in any like go-to-market strategy is, okay, you know, set a goal. I want to acquire 10 customers and figure out, does it cost you more to acquire them than they're worth over the lifetime of their value? Is your CAC to LTV ratio healthy? And that's the thing you want to answer as quickly as possible and then be able to iterate on it until you find the formula that works. And the formula may be digital. It may be, you know, an outsourced sales force. It may be purchasing leads, whatever it is. You find your formula, you show that you can right-size your CAC to LTV, and then you figure out how deep those channels go. And your goal is scale it from 10 to 100, 100 to 1,000, 1,000 to 10,000, and then change your formula as you find channels stop working and you need to adjust your strategies. So it's, you know, but I think it is really important to start at those early days, building your commercialization metrics to say, all right, is our commercialization process working? Do we have a fundamental business that makes sense? Or are we still churning and we're trying to find out whether we can sell things in a profitable fashion? For us, it really was those first e-commerce sales. And we started to grow organically in the beginning and then start to feed in more digital marketing to understand how that influenced the business. And we're able to identify that, you know, paying attention to the fundamentals, we could acquire physicians or clinicians as customers in a B2C fashion and that we could do so profitably. I think we hit, you know, multiple inflection points. There's not a single inflection point. You hit multiple inflection points along the way. Some of them are just smaller. And hopefully as you go along, the inflection points get bigger. And that, you know, kind of continues to curve the trajectory, but it's not necessarily a single point in time. I think you hit inflection points, you know, on a frequent basis as you tune things and get better at it. But that was, you know, that was the real early validation for us was, hey, you know, we can sell this thing profitably and the business does make sense at a basic level.
Mm-hmm. So obviously now you have multiple channels, not B2C anymore. You do the B2B in that the traction from B2C allows you to convince the B2B to pick up on your product. And from there, you flourish to have more offering into more of your digital platform. Yep. Tell us more, like, you know, how many hospitals that you are, your products are in now?
Yeah, in terms of health systems and clinics and practices where we have physicians who are customers, I think at most recent count, we're about 4,000 clinics, practices, health systems, primarily in the US and Europe, using our products. So we've gotten really, really wide adoption, which we're very proud of. And then we've started to go deeper in a much smaller number of practices and build deeper relationships there. And so we've got about 200 health systems where we have software contracts, and we've got those B2B deployments. So you know, we've been really excited to continue to invest in the B2B motion and building out those deeper relationships. But we nicknamed it the Dropbox model for healthcare. You know, Dropbox is, you download the free version of it, you get some, you know, you get a few hundred megabytes of storage and you can use it. But their primary goal is get the employer to pay for it for their employees. So it's a little bit of a bottoms up sales motion in which you're finding the individuals within the organization who will be the champions for the product, giving them the free version and then upselling the pro version to the employer. And so that was really our strategy with B2C was, B2C is it's land, help us get into the doors of the clinic, the doors of the hospital, and then expand is driven by B2B.
And once they have it, they don't want to give that up. And so they have to convince their employers to.
Right. We want to deploy it more rapidly. We want to deploy it at scale. We want to add in data integration capabilities, analysis capabilities. There's just additional features that we're able to unlock.
So maybe it's a good segue for you to tell us about like your product offering, why your technology Echo benefit the patient, the providers, and everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, at the basic level, it's the digital stethoscope and handheld ECG devices that can be used in the clinical setting. So they're designed to be used by individual physicians at the patient's bedside, in the office, to be able to quickly screen patients, hear their heart sounds and lung sounds with more confidence, hear heart murmurs with more confidence. Those are heart murmurs that could be valvular heart disease, you know, aortic stenosis, mitral regurgitation, or be able to screen patients' ECGs, detecting arrhythmias like AFib quickly and easily in the physician's office. And that's the real value to the individual physician is, hey, we want to make you more confident in your physical exam and in your physical, you know, diagnostic process. We want you to be able to hear patients' heart sounds, lung sounds with more confidence. The software can enable real-time transmission of that data. So we can enable high-quality clinic-to-clinic telehealth. So if you have a hub-and-spoke model, if you've got smaller satellite facilities, we can enable real-time, high-quality cardiac exams with heart sounds, lung sounds, and ECG data. Or we can enable clinic-to-home telemedicine and remote patient monitoring. And what we've been able to see this year especially is that's just exploded dramatically. And we're able to provide and power extremely high-quality telehealth visits for cardiovascular pulmonary disease patients with real-time vital sign data transmission. So you can listen to the heart sounds, you can listen to the breath sounds, you can do an ECG exam as if you're with the patient right there, even when they're 1,000 miles away. And so we've built out a more comprehensive offering for home telehealth and home remote patient monitoring.
Does it provide analytics so that, I mean, does a doctor or physician have to listen to the sound or they can just get a report because that would save them a lot of time?
Yeah, so we've built an AI capability that provides analysis of the heart sounds. And so we can provide indications of whether there's a murmur present in the patient's heart sounds. And then we can provide classification of atrial fibrillation, bradycardia, tachycardia, and then also measurement of the QRS duration. So we can do some comprehensive analysis of the heart sounds and ECG in real time in the physician's office in extremely quick fashion.
And this is something like patient with AFib, for example, they need to do this on a regular basis. Then they don't have to go see their doctor, drive and park somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, we do have a lot of folks who have AFib or, you know, there's concern post-ablation, whether the AFib is recurring. So being able to do a very quick rhythm strip exam while the patient's at home under the supervision of the physician and being able to quickly share that data back to the care team makes a big difference in just streamlining access to care and improving the quality of telehealth.
So with the COVID, do you feel that there's a lot more acceleration in adoption to your technology?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been, it's been a very transformative year for us. I think we've seen, you know, just incredible challenges within the healthcare industry and, you know, the heroic work and commitment of physicians to care for their patients in incredibly trying situations. But we have been, you know, we've been excited to see the role that telehealth is playing in improving access to care. I think it's grown the business very, very rapidly this year. And I think in general, we also are big believers that telehealth has to move beyond video conferencing. You can't care for a congestive heart failure patient over Zoom. You got to be able to get vital sign data. You have to be able to hear their breath sounds and listen for crackles. You got to be able to see their rhythm strip. Some of the things you can do in the physician's office that you just can't do over telehealth. And so the remote monitoring aspect of telehealth is absolutely paramount to providing high quality cardiac and pulmonary disease care. So we are very focused on delivering, you know, telehealth 2.0 for these chronic disease patients. Let's move to the next level in which we can have these devices that can provide better quality transmission of vital sign data and help us, you know, conduct high quality exam visits even when the patient's not in the clinic.
That's great. So it's the beginning of 2021. So what's the plan? What's the goal? Like, what are you trying to achieve by 2020, by the end of 21, 22? I mean, like, you know, knowing what you know now.
Well, my personal goal is to get the vaccine this year. I'm very hopeful, waiting in line anxiously. But my
I think you're probably at the bottom of the line. I'm sorry.
I'm at the bottom of the line, yeah. But I'm hopeful that maybe by the end of the year, maybe by the end of the year, we'll see. But I would love that. That would be really nice. Maybe it's a Christmas gift for end of 2021.
So how do you guys work around with this whole shelter in place? How do you keep the team going? Because it's a busy time for you guys to
deliver. It is. I mean, we've made the transition to be primarily remote. You know, any team that doesn't have to be in the office, we keep out of the office, and the majority of our team works remote. And then a handful of folks on the team who, you know, work with hardware or are on a, you know, product team and have to be in the office physically, then we build precautions in for them. But we just minimize that fraction of the workforce so that there's just a very small number of folks who come into the office. And then, you know, we've got a good sized logistics team that helps actually get the product out, shipped, fulfilled to customers. And that team is just incredibly dedicated. And we've taken a lot of extra precautions, getting them PPE, getting them equipment so that they can continue to get products to physicians safely. But I mean, yeah, it's an interesting time being, you know, we were tasked as an essential business. We need to be able to get medical products to physicians. And so, you know, continuing to operate the business, you know, in the midst of a shelter in place was really challenging.
Yeah, it's almost like you're running a good sized company, but because everybody's remote, it's almost like you're running a multinational company. And how do you make sure that everybody's aligned?
Yeah,
Do you have like a routine weekly huddle or I don't know, that keep everybody on the same page?
Yeah, we do an all hands once a week, and that is a nice opportunity just to bring everyone together so that they get on the same page as much as possible. And we found that that's always helpful in just centering people. I think one of the challenges is recognition, I would say. It's hard to recognize people for their contributions in a virtual world. You can't go over and give someone a high five and, you know, give them a quick pat on the back. And it's hard to create that organization-wide visibility to that recognition. You know, when someone goes over and high fives someone else in the office, everyone else gets to see that. Mm-hmm. And so we've been trying to make sure that we give recognition to the incredible work that our team does, even when they're virtual and everyone is kind of so siloed into their own work. But it's, I don't know, well, you know, it's, we're working on it and we don't have the answer by any means.
Yeah. Well, can't wait till everybody get vaccinated and we all come back to what we knew before. And when everybody can come back and be in the same place again. So, well, thank you so much for sharing your stories. And it's been great to have you.
Thanks, Christine. I really appreciate the opportunity. And it was really fun to be here today.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Casper Mossman, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.